Good afternoon. Greetings, faculty, administration, guests, graduates. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a joy to stand before my fellow readers, writers, lovers of literature, word nerds, golden bears. But hold on a sec, I got you. Just hold on a sec. I am so happy for you, and I am happy for the world that is receiving you. I'm also at this moment particularly happy for myself because my first child, a beautiful little girl, was born on May 11th. Thank you. I'll try not to mention her too much. I'll start tearing up. You know, she's brought so much joy, but you'll have to check back in 18 years and get her take on living with me. You know, so commencement calls for advice, and I have to thank Gennaro for that wonderful introduction, because you're right to wonder, why should anyone take advice from a novelist in this economy? So though I stand before you as a novelist, I did serve time in finance. So I will offer you one bit of advice. Be prudent in your use of credit. Every loan is a mortgage on your future. Think of credit as a simple machine. It can be a lever or a screw, and I'm sure you know which one you want. That's the only advice I will offer today. I propose that the topic of the day is simple. How will we obtain the transcendent unity necessary to ensure the survival of the species? But before we answer that, though, I want to be your hype man. These scholars have proven their mettle in the number one English department in, I am going to say, the world. In the firmament that is higher education, UC Berkeley is Polaris, the North Star. It is not easy, am I right? And in doing so, these graduates, each and every one, have demonstrated moral and intellectual courage. On my cue, I'm going to ask you to give them a deafening round of applause. A ridiculously loud round of applause. They have earned that and more. I'm asking you to cheer for these graduates as if our lives depended on them, because they do. Thank you, and I'm not only saying that to assure you of money well spent. I said I got you. Last Thursday, on May 11th at 2303, I became a father, and as a parent, I was granted a license to talk about people right in front of me as if they are not in the same room. I'm going to do that for a minute. I want to address not the graduates, but their guests. Friends, these graduates hail from all around the earth and have assembled here on this campus to study English. What does that mean? There are no shortage of jokes that run somewhat like this. So, you're like earning a degree in the language you were born speaking. Is this what it's like to have long hair? Of course, we know that no one is actually born speaking English. I can now attest to that. But what does it mean to study literature, to take a degree in English? It means these graduates embody this university's very motto and reason for being. Berkeley's motto is Fiat Lux, let there be light. That light may be born of a fire, a distant spark, a valiant star, a neural connection. I assert that these graduates are humanity's light bearers, one and all. What exactly they do, the surfeit of neologisms, critical theory, all those confounding French thinkers, may seem very arcane and esoteric. I assure you, it is not. To illuminate their generous contributions, past, present, and future, I want to talk a little bit about story, a particular story. I want to talk about The King in Yellow, the short story collection by Robert Chambers. In the second story, the narrator visits his friend Boris, a sculptor and self-taught artist. Boris and the narrator are two points of a love triangle, and the third point, Genevieve, is deeply depressed. Boris, perhaps in an effort to impress Genevieve, has developed a solution that instantly fossilizes organic material. When the narrator arrives on the scene, Boris places a fresh lily into a solution and from the basin withdraws a statue in the shape of that same lily. The author writes, "The marble was white as snow, but in its depths, the veins of the lily were tinged with the palest azure, and a faint flush lingered deep in its heart." And later on the page, Chambers writes, "From somewhere within came a rosy light like the tint which slumbers in an opal." The alchemical transformation leaves the living thing dead at first glance. The essence of the lily's form is frozen in stone, except for this heat that remains at the center of the petrified object. And this is precisely what literature is: an amplification of inner light, of the rosy glow, of the spark we all carry. Behind the theory, behind the writing, behind the alphabet itself, behind the zeros and ones if you read ebooks, is simply this incessant, insistent glow, story. We do not do films, blogs, westerns, Amazon miniseries. We do story. Humans cannot survive without story any more than they can survive without sunlight, which fortunately I'm shielded from right now. Story is so powerful that in this age of scientism, when statistics have taken on an aura of mysticism, people are still constructing story. And even though many tech fans cheered after Google's artificial intelligence defeated the human Go champion, even more tech fans cheered when an AI who later named itself Benjamin wrote a screenplay. And when you hear grumbling and glee about big data, you hear analysts reading and writing new stories for us. and political discourse has been reduced to a battle royale of adrenalized narratives. Anytime you are exposed to publicity, you are exposed to a story. So those bedtime stories we tell children, and the stories of mourning and celebration we share with friends and loved ones, and all those advertisements, and all those tweets, the tweets, are all thrown into the same soup. Which ones should we listen to? Which ones do we listen to? Unfortunately, all, because story grafts itself onto our very being. There is no inoculation against it, hence the weaponizing of narrative in the political arena. Milan Kundera believes that every great philosophical idea appears first in a novel. I almost agree. I take that to mean that every great philosophical idea was first transmitted between humans in the form of a story. For example, in the Odyssey, after blinding the Cyclops Polyphemus and smuggling his crew out of that cave, Ulysses tells Polyphemus, "Cyclop, if any pitying thy disgrace, ask, who disfigured thus that eyeless face? Say 'twas Ulysses, 'twas his deed declare, Laertes' son of Ithaca the fair." At that moment, Ulysses, the son of a man, tells Polyphemus, son of Neptune, that a child of God has been bested by a child of man. This assertion of the role of humanity and our agency on Earth and our relative link on the great chain of being is central to our modern world, whether written or shared beside a fire. And in The Outline of History, H.G. Wells writes, "Human history becomes more and more a race between catastrophe and education." I ask you today, friends, what converts catastrophe into education? What converts the execution of a man into a religion? What converts a troubled history of genocide and colonialism into a legend of triumph and discovery? It is story. But what exactly is story? Story is our defense against the chaos of unknowing. The word religion stems from the Latin religare, to bind. This has traditionally been taken to mean that our shared religious values bind us into communities of practice. I, though, take this to mean that our religious narratives bind an otherwise chaotic world into an apprehendable experience. It is this storytelling custom that keeps us whole, keeps us human. Imagine our early ancestors battling the elements, engaged in a struggle to carve life out of a world where death offers not even a trigger warning. At the rugged shores charged by the bitter sea's relentless surge, on arid sands combed by mad, blind winds, and on towering, craggy peaks sculpted by dark heaven's fusillades, who did humans first encounter and find unyielding? Facing a volcano, a razor-clawed feline, an earthquake, how did we make sense of this life? Through stories that became the myths and legends that continue to influence us today. And before my nephew goes to sleep, like many children, he demands a story. My daughter demands only to be fed. I can't help much there. But my nephew needs this story, even if he has heard it before. And while there are reams of research to explain why children enjoy repeatedly reviewing the same stories, when I watch my nephew resist sleep's sly machinations, wrestle those heavy paws, dodge slumber's embrace, I am reminded of and sense in him the improbable weight of nothingness, the void beyond us, what we cannot see and cannot know, the absolute terror and mystery and joy of human existence. a fundamental anxiety we abate with drugs, sex, ritual, television, shopping, technology. An anxiety we have for millennia combated and commanded and restrained through story. We tell stories around the fire, but I am telling you that story is that fire. Story made that fire possible. Story as fire brings to mind Prometheus, and Prometheus may be our rightful muse, because to bring fire to earth is to illuminate life. And when I come to illuminated life, it is time to talk again about both story and literature. Literature, like photography, slows life down long enough for us to grasp and examine thoughts, feelings, impressions that might otherwise remain gauzy intuitions. This slowing down, this fixing in amber, this preserving is crucial. For how else would we know others? Others are too mercurial for us to fully grasp them, even if only because our own personalities and perspectives are mercurial as well. And how else would we know experiences we have not had firsthand? Simply put, life's architecture is too articulated, too fluid and dynamic to be fully grasped by the sense organs, so we need story as literature. And as we age and ossify, how else do we preserve the faint flush lingering deep within our own hearts? Which takes me back to the King in Yellow. The character Boris, whose solution instantly fossilizes organic material, is described in the book as a chemist. Nowhere is alchemy mentioned, and yet when describing the scene, I refer to the alchemical transformation. I did so because alchemy is a metaphor for the transformation of the soul. And of all the arts, because literature is the most intimate, it is literature and the process of engaging and being engaged by it that comes closest to alchemy. There is in alchemy a process known as palingenesis, or the creation and recreation of life from matter previously rendered inert. This is literature. The universal and the particular of human experience are reduced to language, and that language resurrected in the reader's mind as an experience that enthralls and transforms through words. The world is built of words and not things. At the end of The King in Yellow, we learn that the fossilizing effect is not permanent. Eventually, the housekeeper finds goldfish floundering on the floor beneath a mantle where two statues of goldfish once stood. And a room that held a statue of a rabbit is now home to a warm, happy bunny. And what I did not tell you was that Genevieve, in a fit of despair, had thrown herself into a pool of the solution, but now awakes in the cemetery under the watchful eye of the Madonna. How they are different, the goldfish, the rabbit, Genevieve, we are not told, but we imagine that they are changed through their time as, with, and in story, transformed by the faint flush. Literature is that light. In an era and area where immense resources are being invested in dangerous simulacra, these graduates are guardians of that tradition. These graduates are the stewards of our humanity. Thank you. I'm not done. When I originally conceived of this speech, I intended to sidestep politics. I saw no point in telling you what you already know. I saw no need to repeat and regurgitate the wholly unoriginal, predigested, disingenuous political analysis with which we are daily assaulted via screens, large and small. But I was made to believe that you are more than amenable to such engagement. In other words, I was told that this was not the perfect arts and sciences commencement speech because it didn't say anything about Putin or Conway or Bannon or Sessions or prison or getting drunk. So I added a bit. First, you can sleep well tonight knowing that Dwayne Johnson, aka The Rock, is leading in the 2020 presidential polls. So ends the good news. No, you graduates are the good news. The night of the election, I was at a residency in Oregon. After votes were tallied, I witnessed vomiting, soul-wrenching sobs, and the beginning of a miscarriage, a life at risk. The ship of democracy had run aground upon a shoal of doom, and an apocalyptic anxiety took hold as fires long raging in the boiler room ate their way to the observation deck. But fire cleanses. Mount Fuji, the tallest mountain in Japan and a sacred pilgrimage destination, believed to be named after a Buddhist fire god, was formed by a series of violent volcanic eruptions. The venerated summit, fortified by each inferno, was immortalized in a series entitled 36 Views on Mount Fuji. I've written 36 views on the new administration and our explosive political atmosphere, and I will share most of them. Much of your success will be the result of sheer will. If you lacked that, you would not be sitting here. In Pride, Kendrick Lamar writes, "I'll make schools out of prison." In Song 4 of the Constellation of Philosophy, Boethius writes, "Nothing can subdue virtue." Defeat begins in the mind. To submit to despair is to tender your own ruination. We as a species have missed several dinner dates with doomsday. Consider the Jewish revolt against the Romans in 66 AD, Y2K, the Mayan prophecy. The list goes on, yet here we remain. Nothing could be farther from the truth than to fear that the current administration heralds an apocalypse of any sort. Our reigning apocalyptic anxiety is a metaphorical affliction born of a binary morality, informed by Christian eschatology, aggravated by the Western notion of linear time, and most importantly, inculcated through fear, a calculated inculcation of fear. I suggest we radically revise our worldview, our sense of personal power, and our relationship to language. We must reconsider, to paraphrase our own George Lakoff, the metaphors we live by. Are we establishing our own, or are other folks foisting their metaphors upon us? Sometimes we forget that this country has been struggling towards perfection since its inception, and that this administration owns the patent on none of their ideas. Let's think back to the world before November 8th to keep this in perspective. In 2015, the National Center for Trans Equality conducted a nationwide survey. They learned that trans folks were more than twice as likely as the U.S. population to be living in poverty, and trans folks of color were up to three times as likely as the U.S. population to be living in poverty. What I am telling you is that we are always fighting. Our prison population swelled under a tremendously popular Democratic president. What I am telling you is that we are always fighting. In 2015, 89% of colleges reported zero rapes. Keyword reported. What I am telling you is that we are always fighting. In 1993, the man who founded the Federation for Immigration Reform, as well as the Petoskey chapter of the Sierra Club, wrote in a letter to a colleague, "I have come to the point of view that for European American society and culture to persist requires a European American majority, and a clear one at that. What I am telling you is that we are always fighting." Promise Keepers, whose ensign is spookily similar to an Army Ranger patch, and the rest of the constitutional refuseniks are nothing new either. In 1868, a benevolent organization was chartered to protect the weak, the innocent, and the defenseless from the outrages of lawlessness, to protect and defend the Constitution, and to aid and assist in the execution of all constitutional laws. That benevolent organization formed to protect the weak and safeguard the Constitution is known today as it was then as the KKK. What I'm telling you is that we are always fighting. In other words, if we awoke tomorrow with a Westminster parliamentary system and our legislators passed a resolution of no confidence, we would immediately be cured of nothing, of absolutely nothing. But if we could be cured, how would we react to the news that approximately every 28 hours a trans person is killed somewhere on this earth? If we say that this is the worst that it's ever been, we discount the experience of many Americans who will tell you that life here has always been a struggle. I say this not to discourage you, but to encourage you, to remind you that, as Reverend King said, the arc of history is long. This country holds today every promise it ever held, and, as has always been the case, these promises are seated in our hearts and will be brought to flesh only if we are committed to engaging fully in our lives. Our greatest risk is the adoption of practices and behaviors that betray our values. You must be an evangelist for hope, proselytize for empathy and charity. Your outrage is the call to action. Wonder not what to do. The starting point is simple. Make no distinction between your personal and political selves because they are the same. We have been told all our lives to avoid discussing in mixed company politics, money, or religion, but those are the three arms that crank the wretched machinery in which we now labor. We must not give up. We must not become language apostates. Since the election, many people have told me they are no longer talking to their families. That's not helping, because the only weapon they cannot confiscate is your heart. If white people do not talk to white people about racism, and men to men about sexism, and heterosexuals to heterosexuals about homophobia, we surrender the power to leverage homogeneity in the service of heterogeneity. It is incredibly hard to talk peaceably to those with whom you violently disagree, but community and communication and connection is the only cure. In a Pan-African occult text, it is written, there are no concrete realities called medicines and poisons. There exist medicinal relations and toxic relations. And Martin Buber wrote, a soul is never sick alone, but there is also always a betweenness, a situation between it and another human being. If, as Buber suggests, Maladies of the soul are not born in solitude, neither are ecstasies and education. And one of those ecstasies, educations, and avenues of betweenness is art, especially literature. You are schooled in this. Embrace this occasion with all your might. This is what we do. We struggle always and forever until all people are free. Ask yourself this: what converts catastrophe into education? The answer is inside of you. Darkness is not intractable. It quails at light. Fiat lux. Thank you.